Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com, a gathering place for people who love movies. Sign up for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Maddie Robinson. This week, a show brought to you by the AARP. We'll share our top five senior citizens on screen.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Bottle Rockets, and we kick off our Ingmar Bergman marathon with a review of his 1955 romp, Smiles of a Summer Night.
We'll also offer up a quick preview of the upcoming Chicago International Film Festival. But first, Adam and I discover ourselves and nature with a walk into the wild.
And why did you do that?
I don't need money. It makes people cautious.
Come on, Alex. Got to be a little cautious. I mean, that book of yours is cool and everything, but you can't depend entirely on leaves and berries.
I don't know if you want to depend on much more than that.
Where are your mom and dad?
Living their lives somewhere.
When John Krakauer first published the story of Chris McCandless's fatal trek into the Alaskan wild in Outside Magazine in 1993, many readers bemoaned the glorification of a 24-year-old kid who, in their minds, pretty much got what he deserved. Following graduation from Emory University in 1999, McCandless burned his ID cards, donated all $24,000 of his savings to charity, changed his name to Alex Supertramp, and departed on a 2-year spiritual journey across America, eventually finding his own makeshift fortress of solitude in the unforgiving Alaskan wilderness. McCandless would spend 112 days living and ultimately dying in an abandoned bus, getting by on rice, roots and berries, and the writings of Thoreau, Tolstoy, and London. In a bit of irony he would surely despise, McCandless's quest spawned a catchy phrase, pulling a McCandless. Joseph Chambers, a master's student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, offers three interpretations of the phrase he helped coin. One who pulls a McCandless is the hero, a person following their dreams, seeking to test themselves with adversity and risk in order to live life fully, or the soul searcher, a person abandoning social conventions in an effort to seek truth and to discover the true self that remains hidden under social constraints, a person striving to stick to their deepest values and convictions no matter what the cost, or the dumb jerk, a person who is futilely questing for something meaningless or worthless, a person who is woefully unprepared for a trip, who clings to misguided, self-righteous principles, losing friends and hurting themselves and their family in the process. In glancing at some of the responses to Sean Penn's new film, Into the Wild, adapted from Krakauer's 1996 bestseller, I found it interesting that a number of critics have taken the same tack as the initial McCandless detractors. They see McCandless as the dumb jerk. He's preachy, unprepared, and possibly mentally disturbed. Some hero. How do you see McCandless, Maddie, and how much did your reaction to McCandless the man, as portrayed here by Emil Hirsch, influence your enjoyment of the film?
You know, going in, I was a little trepidatious because it's Sean Penn. And, of course, here's an outspoken person with huge beliefs. And we're living in a time where, sure, why not? Doesn't it cross your mind, my God, why don't we just turn our back on everything and go out into nature? And I was worried. I was a little bit worried that perhaps that's what he was going to try and put before us mm-hmm. and really campaign for. But he doesn't do this. This film is every single one of those things you just said.
Yeah.
And no, he's not. Chris McCandless is not a guy I would want to talk to at a cocktail party. But that's okay. It's all right I don't like him. It's all right if I think he's a dumb jerk. It's okay if I think he's self-indulgent. This film, it really isn't a film. It's more of a document. It's snapshots. It's songs. It's chapters. It's verse. All put together to capture this journey that this 24-year-old kid goes on. And that's okay. You don't need to come. I think it's absolutely stupid to turn your back on this movie because you don't like this kid.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, in the end, I know we don't want to get to the ending that quickly. I think he comes to a realization that, yeah, he is being pretty selfish. And why don't we go along with that ride?
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think we saw this film the exact same way. And I think that those comments from Joseph Chambers, who he was an undergrad at the time, and then now he's just a master's student, I think. But
he
and his friends became really obsessed with this movie because they were going through the same thing where they were transitioning out of college at the time that this happened. And so they came up with this phrase, pulling a McCandless, in this article I came across. And I thought it was really funny. And I agree, it's really limiting, but all three of those apply, I think, to this character. I think you can see him very much as the hero or a soul searcher or a dumb jerk. Those are all there. And those layers are what make the film interesting.
Yeah, and Penn is constantly putting different characters in front of McCandless' path to challenge him, to challenge his ideas, to convince him to go back to his parents, to realize how stubborn he is being.
Mm-hmm.
So that's there. It's readily apparent.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that some people may be wanting to criticize the film for, in a way, glorifying him. I actually think Penn goes out of his way not to glorify
exactly.
him. I think that the fact that you see such a clear presence of the quote-unquote dumb jerk in this film makes it very clear that he really could have gone out of his way to make him more noble, to make this quest really, truly spiritually uplifting and something we all, as you said, could get behind and maybe want to even go out and do ourselves. Clearly, Penn isn't really interested in that. He's interested in documenting, I think, as you said, this kind of journey that this character goes on, and is not suggesting in any way that it's a quest we all should be going on or that it was completely justified, because he did learn a lot by the time he gets to the end. Let's be clear. There are chapters, as you said, that I think are really interesting. Penn saw this narrative in terms of chapters of starting out this journey. It was only 2 years, but in those 2 years, he went from birth to adolescence to middle life and then to the end of his life in those 2 years. And I think that's a really fantastic conceit that he came up with, and I think it works. And by the end, it's only by the end in death that eventually he comes to some kind of wisdom. He doesn't have the wisdom before it. And the fact is, if you really wanted to glorify Emil Hirsch's character, if you wanted to glorify Chris McCandless in this film, you could have done so by making him way more articulate. The fact is, when he tries to explain to people what he's doing, and in terms of me as an audience member,
when he's most articulate, it's when he's quoting Thoreau.
It's true, exactly. And as we all know, people being able to regurgitate famous authors or great authors doesn't mean they're smart. It just means they have a good memory, and they have good taste, maybe. And that's all he can really do. He isn't necessarily a deep thinker on his own, though we do get the sense that he obviously can think for himself. And the fact that he wants to think for himself is interesting enough.
Exactly. He's a young man who doesn't know who he is. And I think actually the disparity between the characters that Sean Penn surrounds him with and the sort of lack of character, the lack of charisma in Emil Hirsch's portrayal of this character is really profound and neat, because as he comes across these people, we want him to learn these lessons from them. And, you know, it's so great because we're learning as we go along, right along with him. And I was really wondering what you thought as a father. Now, William Hurt and Marcia Gay Harden are terrific as Chris McCandless' parents here, but they are just put through the ringer.
Mm-hmm.
Their son disappears for two and a half years, and they have no idea where he is. And I was wondering how you felt now that you're a dad.
Yeah. Well, watching it was very difficult. I mean, you are thinking about what if that happened. Could you imagine your child turning their back on you completely? And I think that that's another interesting thing about the film, the complexity of it that Penn gets at. It's very clear that he wants to go out into the wild because he is on this heroic quest following those terms we set up. He is soul searching. He's trying to test himself, all those things. But he is also very clearly running away from his family and trying to seek some kind of truth, because he sees his home life with a very dysfunctional family as fraudulent.
And Penn doesn't give him a pass on that.
And
I really
Penn,
like that.
He absolutely doesn't give them a pass, but at the same time, we do come to appreciate the pain that they go through as parents, and they come out differently than they started, just as he, in the end, finally comes to some sort of revelation, though it's way too late by that point. And that's the interesting thing, too. You're right. He meets these interesting characters along the way. Catherine Keener, and we didn't look up the actor's name.
Right.
We're really curious about him. We should have, who plays her hippie husband, I guess, in the film. They're really interesting. Also, Hal Holbrook is great here.
He's fantastic.
He's only here for, unfortunately, maybe 10 minutes of total time, but has this old guy who encounters him and takes him in and really wants to adopt him. And everyone wants to take him in, because they all get what Chris doesn't understand till too late, which is that it is all about sharing that personal experience, and that solitude isn't necessarily the answer to your problems.
Yeah, and I just, you know, you look at those scenes with his parents, and eventually he becomes trapped. I don't want to give it away, but he becomes trapped in the wilderness, and you just want to stand up and scream, "You dumb little kid.
Yeah.
Why did you have to be so naive? Didn't you get it?" And so that's why I don't like these critics that are turning their back on it just because they want to say, "Oh, this stupid kid. Why should we glorify this kid?"
Right.
Well, the fact of the matter is, no, you really get invested in the story.
Yeah, I think you do get invested in it, and you're right. It's a lot of wilderness people as well, if that's the right phrase, a lot of people who would read Outside Magazine, they read it and go, "Well, this guy's an idiot. I spend a lot of time making sure that I know exactly what I'm doing and I'm prepared." But I saw Sean Penn on Charlie Rose a week or so ago, I think, and he talks about this film, and he talks about the fact that that's the way Chris was. He was the kind of guy who said, okay, if you're going to live outside of society's boundaries and their distinctions, the way to do it, and this was the type of guy he was in a lot of walks of life and a lot of facets, was you just dismiss the map. You say the map doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. That's how he tried to live. We can all sit there and laugh at that and say, well, you know what, maybe he got what was coming. I don't see how you can think that, though. You can think he was naive, and he absolutely was naive, but you can see what he was trying to achieve, and I don't see how you can't respect it, and I do respect it.
No, exactly, and when I say I get mad at the end of the film, it's I'm only responding to what this film presents and the emotion that it churns up, and that's why I think it's so terrific.
But I think it's worth noting that in addition to the story that we were obviously both invested in, Penn as a filmmaker here, I think, has taken a really interesting leap forward in terms of the style of this film. I think you're going to hear a lot of people compare it to Terrence Malick, and people will talk about Werner Herzog because of the way it uses nature. It has this epic kind of scope to it. It's also very lyrical, so it does make you think of Malick. But at the same time, Malick is a guy who really, I think, loves nature.
Talk
in
about
a way.
Throwing away the map.
Yeah,
that's Terrence Malick.
It is. It's Terrence Malick. That's a good point. And he is way more interested, I think, in many ways in nature than his characters.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Sean Penn is that way at all. There aren't a lot of lingering, graceful shots of nature. There's a lot of quick, there's a lot of kind of slow motion, but it's always about how nature is in relation to
the
that
story.
Character
exactly.
in this story.
Yeah.
And I see that dynamic here very much. And it's also not like Herzog, who is there to simultaneously show the wonder of nature and how terrible it is. That's not really here either. I actually thought, to be honest, and I may be way out there here, but I thought a lot of Oliver Stone in Natural Born Killers. Take Natural Born Killers in terms of its inventiveness and its style, but tone it way down, not trying to be in your face at all or kind of bludgeon you with its style and its intensity, but that kind of the way he uses montage to tell a story. I mean, this really is about images, whether it's slow motion or speeded up, whatever, colliding with each other. And I think that in a way, that's how he captures McCandless's story. I love the fact that Penn doesn't try to give us this kind of linear narrative and say, this is how it happened. We don't know. We know based on some of the things he wrote. We know from Krakauer's book and the research he did.
Yeah.
But we don't really know. And the only way to capture a guy's two-year episodic journey around the country is to show it in this way that throws time and space completely out the window. And I think it's really interesting.
Into the Wild is now out in very limited release. But if you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
Time for a quick break. When we come back, Maddie Ballgame is Gollum. A Peter Jackson-laden edition of Listener Feedback is next. Stay with us.
Adam and Maddie, this is James Eric from Chicago, Illinois. Just calling in because it was a very interesting weekend for movies. Eastern Promises was good, not great. The Brave one was kind of reprehensible, aside from the acting. But there simply could not be a worse film that I've seen so far this year than Across the Universe. The acting was stale and stoic, and in terms of the songs moving a storyline forward and musical narrative, Across the Universe made Moulin Rouge look like Singing in the Rain.
Hey guys, it's Mark calling from Dallas. Just wanted to give some feedback on the top five overrated directors. I think you pretty much are safe. I don't think there's anything too controversial. I would pretty much agree. The one I would add, though, for me is the Wachowski brothers. I thought The Matrix was a pretty good movie. Certainly it's been one of the more influential movies of the last few years, but it had two boring, bloated, pretentious sequels. They supposedly did some work on V for Vendetta, which I didn't think was that great, and they supposedly came in and did some directing work on The Invasion, which didn't seem to help at all. To me, they seem very overrated. I guess next summer's Speed Racer will either help or hurt them. I'm not sure, but in any case, keep up the good work. Talk to you later.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. A couple of great voicemails there, and what was a great week for listener feedback, and we really wanted to devote this whole segment to your responses to Across the Universe and our top five overrated directors. Mark there chiming in with the Wachowski brothers, or the Wachowski brothers,
yeah,
if you're nasty. I totally agree with him. I did consider them, but I also thought at this point, it's kind of like, again, what you said about Ivan Reitman, kicking them when they're down. Really, does anyone put them on a pedestal anymore?
I don't
anymore?
Understand. They're laughing all the way to the bank. They made one great movie, The yeah. Matrix, with a great mythology.
And then, Bound is pretty good.
And yeah, Bound is great. And then the studio came back and said, all right, well, we're going to sell some T-shirts with this and franchise this Matrix thing. So mm-hmm. come up with a story. Well, they don't care. They're laughing all the way to the bank.
No,
although
Beat
for Vendetta was atrocious.
Yes, it was. So, okay. Well, we love that voicemail. And also James Eric there, the movie freak, with some thoughts on Across the Universe. And it's worth noting that, no, James was not just regurgitating what we said. I can say that he actually sent that voicemail, I think, the day we recorded our show. It just turns out he had the exact same reaction to it that we did. But instead of piling on Julie Taymor and Across the Universe, we did have a few listeners who wrote in to defend her.
Like Dominique from Montreal. Are you guys completely insane? Everybody I know who saw Across the Universe simply adored it. Hell, the audience I saw it with actually applauded at the end of the film. I saw it a week ago, and every day since, I've had a different Beatles song in my head. I can't believe you described some of the choreography as ridiculous. We mustn't have been watching the same film. From the giddy bowling alley scene set to I've Just Seen a Face to the almost terrifying Uncle Sam theme I Want You sequence, Across the Universe has a unique, pretty much mind-blowing visual style. In fact, this is a movie that probably won't hold up so well on DVD, given how its inventive look is an integral part of the film. In the end, you don't watch Across the Universe, you experience it. You guys obviously missed out, and I feel sad for you.
I guess we did miss out. Nice experience there for Dominique. You know, I had a Beatles song in my head every day for 2 weeks, too. It doesn't mean the movie's good. It just means the music is good. And you did actually single out the I Want You sequence as one that you liked.
I did like I Want You. I thought that was the most Taymor-esque mm-hmm. of all the film, where she was allowed to be inventive along the lines of what she created in The Lion King.
Mm-hmm. And in contrast to that, you have the I've Just Seen a Face sequence in the bowling alley, which Dominique also chimed in on. And
which the Coen brothers did so much better in The Big Lebowski.
Exactly, as a few listeners did want to point out to us. But it also ruined one of my favorite Beatles songs. Again, just like Dear Prudence, I've Just Seen a Face. I had to suffer through that, unfortunately. But let's move on to someone else who wants to defend Miss Taymor. Stephanie Pushaw in Malibu, California. I saw Across the Universe September 15th and absolutely loved it. I'm a huge Beatles fan, and I expected to be disappointed with the movie, but instead I found it refreshing to hear the actors' unique takes on each song. After going home and, yes, purchasing the soundtrack, I read very mixed reviews of the movie and wondered what I liked so much about it. So last night I went to see it again. The second time I saw the flaws that had been pointed out, such as the disjointed feel of much of the movie, but I still loved it. Although this movie is sure to be controversial among Beatles fans, as they may see it as a butchering of classic songs, I was entirely charmed by it. I may be in the minority, but I've just seen a movie I can't forget.
Well, it's very nicely put. And, you know, we have to mention, I think this is the only film at the Toronto International Film Festival that Roger Ebert went to go see twice. So, actually, I think a lot of people, yes, they're Beatles fans, are forgiving this film just a little bit, just mm-hmm. because they were just so eager to see these songs on screen.
Let's move on to our overrated director's comments, and it might be a good place to start with the poll question from last week. This will set everything up here, I think. We asked you which director is the most overrated. The choices were Brian De Palma, Tim Burton, Terry Gilliam, Peter Jackson, or M. Night Shyamalan, and then you also had the option of saying none. They're all great. Maddie, how did it come out?
Well, it was a pretty overwhelming victory for M. Night Shyamalan. He came in 253 votes at 36%. In second, Brian De Palma at 27%. Tim Burton at 16%, Peter Jackson at 9%, Terry Gilliam at 7%, and none, they're all great, at 4%.
Yes, it was a win for M. Night Shyamalan. I have to say, I'm a little bit surprised. He made your list. I thought he would be a popular choice, but maybe not number one among those options. Peter Jackson in there, as you said, did get 9%, and we thought last week that we were just going to be inundated with hate mail. And I think we decided that maybe the people who heard what you had to say about Peter Jackson and really hated it probably just unsubscribed or stopped listening. Whereas everyone else, we actually got a ton of people who wrote in and defended our top five choices, and including Peter Jackson. But we do have to start with someone who says you're nuts, and that is Daniel from San Francisco. Dan says, Just when I thought Sam's departure had gone off without a hitch, Maddie has to go and drill Pete Jackson and Richard Linklater. Now, I don't want to argue that Pete Jackson is a great filmmaker. I don't think he is or ever will be. He makes some silly choices in his films, but you need to give him some credit for what he did with Lord of the Rings. I'm not sure anybody else could have taken on such a gigantic project and pulled it off with such success. Again, I'm not saying he's a great director. I don't think anyone would call him a great director, but overrated? Come on, Maddie. Just because you don't like the books aren't reason enough to say he's overrated. Pretty soon we'll have to start calling you Maddie Van Ballgame.
Yeah, Jordan Parmenter follows up with, Maddie, your top five was perfect as well. I'm constantly telling people that Robert Rodriguez sucks. You did a great job until your number one pick, when your top five devolved into rambling, incoherent, frothing at the mouth, crazy talk.
Yeah, so a few people, of course, did feel like we were way out of line, including Peter Jackson there. I would actually go back to what Dan from San Francisco said. That's why I would say he's not overrated. I think you do have to respect the achievement that is Lord of the Rings, whether or not you're really into it. And there's been some great discussion in our message board, some really heavy dissection of the film. And they know way more about the source material and the films than I do, so I can't really weigh in. But I think that's why I would not include him on my list. But I certainly understand why you might, Maddie. Let's move on to this one from Dominic Padulo in Wellesley Hills, Massachusetts. His top five, Steven Spielberg. Granted, Indiana Jones is awesome, but being 17, I am far more familiar with his misses as opposed to his successes. Jaws has always been campy to me.
Oh, jeez.
Schindler's List derails whenever Ralph Fiennes is out of the picture, and I absolutely cannot stand E.T., which is blasphemy,
wow.
I think.
Wow.
Number four, Dominic has Peter Jackson. I've argued against Lord of the Rings numerous times at school, but no one seems to agree with me that while it may be pretty to look at, once CGI improves, they'll be forgotten.
I've always liked Dominic.
Number three, Robert Zemeckis. He stole Quentin Tarantino's directing Oscar, nuff said. Number two, Ron Howard. I can't believe that someone can become so acclaimed for making such bland, easy-to-digest movies. And number one, Ang Lee. I've always been put off by Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and have never been able to see Brokeback Mountain as anything better than a melodramatic love story that labels you as homophobic if you don't like it. I'm not, by the way. Dominic wants to make sure we don't think he's homophobic because he didn't like Brokeback Mountain. Yeah. But I think he's crazy for not liking Brokeback and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Agreed, the Hulk is a mess, but that's why Ang Lee.
Well, I think Dominic should
list.
Go check out The Ice Storm, which is one of my favorite movies.
Okay.
Easily in the 90s.
Okay, well, some interesting choices there, and I know you were a little bit surprised, actually, to see Ron Howard, though our listeners really did kind of give him a beating.
I mean, what do you want from Opie? I mean, he makes solid studio movies.
He does.
I love Apollo 13. I think The Paper is flawed, but a good watch. I like Splash. Come on, Splash, and then a Cinderella Man. I think that's terrific.
Yeah, Cinderella Man is really good, and I'm actually one of those people, we'll confess, to liking A Beautiful Mind. I think it's a good film. I don't know if it's best picture quality, but I think it's a good film. So maybe not Ron Howard, but I think what I said too in our message boards to someone is Ron Howard is just a guy who turns out good kind of quality money-making films. Other than Hollywood producers, does anyone really think he's great? I guess that's why I didn't consider him for my list.
Now, actually, I would put Apollo 13 in the pantheon. I know my pantheon isn't up. I love Apollo 13.
Wow. Okay, you really are into space, aren't you?
Okay,
well, let's move on then, Maddie. You take this one from Brett Merriman. I know you really appreciate Brett's number five.
Ooh, Dario Argento. Talking about what Argento was going for is always more interesting than what he does. Very well put. Number four, a tie, Terry Gilliam and Tim Burton. They've never met a visual flourish they didn't like. Not interested in narrative film. Number three, Michael Moore, the Starbucks of documentarians. Number two, Ed Zwick, About Last Night, Glory, Legends of the Fall, Courage Under Fire, The Siege, The Last Samurai, Blood Diamond, a very important director of big TV movies. A-list actors pull me in, but I always feel suckered after a Zwick. No more. And number one, Paul Schrader. Taxi Driver was 31 years ago. Great script. Thank you, Mr. Schrader. Now go away.
Every film he directs is unenjoyable from any criterion, Brett says about Paul Schrader. That may be
true. He's making
me
think of a film, and I can't remember it right now. Something about Paradise with Joseph Fiennes, and he's disfigured, and I think Gretchen Mol is in it.
It's a Paul Schrader film?
Oh, it's unwatchable.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Well, I also like what Brett had to say about Michael Moore and Terry Gilliam and Tim Burton. Of course, those two made my list. And even if I don't necessarily completely agree with Michael Moore there at number three, the way Brett said it, you now know why Brett gets read a lot on the show. Some great comments there. TJ Wells has a great top five here. And TJ is a regular listener, longtime listener. And we actually both read this list and said, I wish that we had thought of this or had this list before we formed ours.
This is my list.
He says, number five, Paul Haggis. There's really not much that needs to be said here. Number four, Sam Mendes with American Beauty, Jarhead, and to a point, Road to Perdition, probably the most overrated director of the past 10 years. Oliver Stone. I don't think he's made a truly memorable, for good reasons, film since JFK. Sydney Pollack. Yes, I love Tootsie, but The Interpreter, Sabrina remake, Random Hearts, maybe it's time to throw in the towel. And number one, Milos Forman, he's made two great movies, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Amadeus, but since 1984, he's made two okay movies, The People vs. Larry Flint and Man on the Moon, and one bad one, Goya's Ghost. I think TJ's on to something.
Yeah, I can only second. Goya's Ghost will probably go down as my worst film of the year.
Yeah, you did see that. I remember you telling me about how brutal that film was. But Milos Forman, I think I'm giving him a pass because he did make at least one masterpiece, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and I love Amadeus. But Sidney Pollack is another one of those guys who I really always feel like, oh, yeah, I like Sidney Pollack. Who doesn't like Sidney Pollack as a director?
What's the Sidney Pollack canon, though, when you really think about it? Then, you can't come off the top of your head, you know?
That's it. When you actually start to look at the list, as TJ obviously did, The Interpreter and Sabrina and Random Hearts, and I did then go to IMDb and I looked down the list, and it's like, other than Tootsie, there isn't much there. Sidney Pollack and Milos Forman, two inspired choices there. We did appreciate all the great feedback this week.
Yeah, we did. As always, if you've got feedback, email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
Time for another quick break. When we return, Massacre Theater, and we'll find out if Maddie's Uncle Sven, and I'm not kidding, just because he grew up on a Minnesota farm, he really does actually have an uncle named Sven. We'll find out if he taught him anything about Ingmar Bergman. Stay with us.
If I could be a little bit younger, if I could be a little bit older, if I could be a little bit friendlier, if I could be a little bit colder, then I would be a little bit better. Yeah, I would be a little bit better. But I'm a middleman, stuck in the middle, right between anything tangible. Just a middleman, looking for a little, something that'll make me more.
Time now to take a look at what's new on DVD coming out this Tuesday. Not a great week for DVD releases, Maddie, but there is one movie I think we're both probably pretty curious to check out here off the top, and that is 1408. This is the Stephen King adaptation.
Oh, yeah.
Samuel L. Jackson, John Cusack in this film. And it's a movie that includes the disc commentary by the director and the screenwriters. But this is a movie that, here on Film Spotting, we decided to skip. Didn't look interesting. Looked like kind of a conventional horror movie. Mm-hmm. And it really got strong reviews. A lot of critics really liked this film.
Oh,
so,
I thought it just came and went.
No, it didn't. Well, I think it did in theaters, but it was pretty critically highly regarded. So it's one I am looking forward to catching up with now that it's out on
DVD.
What
did you think about the Fantastic Four?
What's funny is I actually watched the Fantastic Four 2 on the way to Toronto. It was on our flight on Air Canada. One of our listeners, Nick, actually responsible for programming that for me.
No
so
kidding.
Thank you, Nick, who we met up with there in Toronto. But it includes two commentary tracks, and there's a two-disc special edition. I can't imagine wanting to listen to that. It's pretty brutal. It's actually a little bit more enjoyable than the first Fantastic Four, though. Also out, the Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula, 75th anniversary edition. This is the Coppola version. It includes commentary, a documentary, all sorts of extra features. So that is out now. And then the 40th anniversary of The Jungle Book, platinum edition, a movie my kids, Holden and Sophie, really enjoy. The Jungle Book. Who doesn't enjoy The Jungle
Louis
Book?
Louis Prima, I believe, is the King of the Apes.
Okay. I think you're right, actually. So that's a look at what's new on DVD. We wanted to take a moment before donations just to mention two things related to Maddie. One, you can go to spout.com, filmspotting.spout.com, ask Maddie all sorts of interesting questions about life, about movies, about whatever. He's glad to answer them. So go to filmspotting.spout.com, our Spout group, and ask Maddie. You can't miss the thread there in the discussions. But also, Maddie,
you wanted
to take a moment or two to talk about a couple films just briefly that you've seen over the past couple weeks, because so far you have been kind of negative with the movies we've reviewed through your first three reviews anyway. Mm-hmm. It was pretty negative. You've seen a couple movies that I think would surprise people you've really liked.
Well, I think we also mentioned that I actually get to see some more movies mm-hmm. than you do, because you are, with the hockey season starting,
really busy right now.
But I was able to catch up with 310 to Yuma, which I think we might actually discuss next week. But
yes,
I really did enjoy it. I have a couple questions about the ending, and anybody out there in Film Spotting land that wants to email me about it, I really sort of felt it was kind of tacked on and incongruent with the rest of the mm-hmm. film. Also saw Jane Austen Book Club.
You did.
I did, which
I was in shock.
Why? See, this is the thing. This is the old Film Spotting. You and Sam showed no love for these, quote-unquote, I'm not trying to be demeaning, chick flicks.
Uh-huh.
And it's actually, I really, really enjoyed it. It's a great date movie.
Hmm. And also, Starter for 10?
Started
with
for
my
10,
boy James
another
McAvoy.
Another great date movie. Check them all out.
Okay.
Well, Started for 10 is available on DVD, I think.
Yes, and Jane Austen's book club is in theaters now. Let's get to donations then. It's been a couple weeks since we have thanked our generous listeners who have donated to the show. And as we said, as Sam was on his way out the door, he is still providing nicknames. We promise these are your patented Sam Van Halgren nicknames that you can find on filmspotting.net in the right rail. Look for the donations link. We do have a lot of names to thank over the past couple weeks. Maddie, start us off.
All right. Well, I will start with our Silver Club members. Alexander, Lord of the Sabbath. Suzuki, Spare Me Your Chumpitude. Janet, The Chimes at Midnight. Robert, Gold Standard Assassination. And then we'd also like to thank Tasula, Breath of Zeus, Michael, Wrath of the Apologist, Ming Tai, Question Mark Ascendancy, Matthew, Bizarre Love Parallelogram, Mary, Descent into Happiness, Chris, Irresistible Invisibility, John with no H, Passive Aggressive Tabby, John with an H, German Espressoism, and Mitchell, Mama Will You Bark.
Inspired stuff from Sam. This week, thank you to everyone who donated. A few repeat donors in there, actually, including Alexander. I think he's also the Burn Redeemer. We do appreciate your generosity. One last quick note. For people who have seen In the Valley of Elah, at the end of this show, in the outtake of the show, there's going to be a little spoiler edition where I am going to weigh in on how Paul Haggis could have redeemed the terrible ending to his film. So if you've seen it or you don't plan to see it and don't care and actually are curious enough to hear it because we both really railed on that ending,
yeah.
I'm going to offer a script suggestion. I normally get paid big bucks for this, of course, to be a script doctor, but here I'm going to do it for free at the end of the show. So if you're curious, stay tuned to the outtake. But I'm a middle man, stuck in the middle, right between anything tangible, just a little man.
Hey, there's a cyclops.
Zombie's got two eyes.
It must be a bicyclops. There's another one. Whole cyclopedia. There's a school of whales.
Hey, look, they're a bit old for school.
University, then.
University of Wales.
Well, they look like dropouts to me.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I massacre a screenplay and you, the listener, get a shot at a free DVD. Last week, Adam and I massacred, yes, the Beatles' quote-unquote 1968 classic, Yellow Submarine, a tie-in with last week's discussion, an obvious tie-in, as it turns out, with Julie Taymor's Across the Universe.
Yes, it was fairly obvious, if not the fact that it was Beatles and Across the Universe, but our Liverpoolian accents did give it away. Like an idiot, I suggested that it would be a hard massacre theater. It was apparently very easy.
Well, I thought the fact that you were doing Pete Best instead of Ringo might actually throw them, but
you
all
caught
for
on to that. I'm so glad someone noticed, at least you noticed, Maddie.
Well, we did have a winner, so why don't you reach into the film spotting hat and pick one out.
And the winner is Melinda Hale from Provo, Utah. Three names I always enjoy, Marvin, Velma, and Provo. Congratulations. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, Melinda, and we'll set you up with a DVD of your choice.
The other day, when I heard Mr. Fabian tell Miss Channing that her understudy was going to have a baby, and they'd have to replace her.
And you want to be Margaret's new understudy?
I don't let myself think about it ever.
Moving on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. It ties in with our top five this week. Top five senior citizens on screen. So someone old will be in this scene, and as it turns out, someone young is in the scene. That's really probably all we need to say, and I have a feeling, Maddie, it's another one that is going to be really painfully obvious, but we're going to run with it.
Sounds good.
I started off, so you once again get to be the director.
All right. Action.
I don't want to be a loser.
You're not a loser. Where did you get that idea that you're a loser?
Because Dad hates a loser.
Whoa. Back up a minute. You know what a loser is? A real loser is someone who's so afraid of losing they don't even try. Now, you're trying, right?
Yes.
Then you're not a loser. We're going to have fun tomorrow, right?
Yes.
Now, you can tell them all to go to hell. Good night, sweetie. I love you.
And scene.
Now, if you know what film Adam and I just massacred, email your name and location. Very important, include your location, to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, October 3rd. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's podcast. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
All right. Well, before we get to our first film in the Bergman Marathon, Maddie, we did want to take a moment just to preview the Chicago International Film Festival. We just came back from Toronto, and now the Chicago Film Festival is going on. Your first year with the Chicago Film Festival. Sam and I did cover it last year, and we did just want to take a few minutes to kind of set this up. We will have some coverage from this festival. It actually kicks off in earnest on Friday, October 5th, but Thursday night is the opening night film, the Mark Forster film, The Kite Runner. We actually wanted to maybe just spend a few minutes highlighting the movies that we're most curious about, just to give you an idea of what we're going to be seeing, and also if you're coming to the area, what may be worth your time to see. So, Maddie, what two or three movies at this year's festival are you most intrigued about?
Well, I really want to see Grace Is Gone. I think you and Sam actually saw that in Sundance.
And it's
John Cusack, basically a story about Iraq, right?
Mm-hmm.
He is at home, and
his wife is actually in Iraq and ends up dying, and he has to deal with telling his daughters that their mom is gone.
I'm looking forward to that. And The Savages with Laura Linney.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we might possibly get a chance to interview Laura on this very show.
Yes, we're hoping we're going to get a shot at interviewing Laura Linney. That should be a lot of fun. I'm going to let you do it, Maddie, if we get that chance. It's a good thing Sam's gone with this opportunity.
What about you? What are you looking forward to?
Well, just one quick note on The Savages. It played at Sundance 2 with Philip Seymour Hoffman also in that film, and we didn't get a chance to see it.
Oh.
It played in Toronto, and we didn't get to see it there, so hopefully we will get to catch up with it here in Chicago. I know you're also intrigued about Control, the Joy Division movie.
Yeah, because I saw Joy Division, the documentary, in Toronto, and I'm really excited to see Sam Riley in the role of Ian Curtis.
Of course, who we had here on the show in an interview from Toronto. So those three are kind of the ones you're really looking forward to. My top three right now, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, a film from Romania that actually won the Palme d'Or at the last Cannes Film Festival, and The Kite Runner, based on Kelen Hosseini's bestseller. It actually opens the festival. And then there's two other films I'll quickly mention: Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, P.S. Hoffman, and that one along with Ethan Hawke, directed by Sidney Lumet, who's now like 83 years old. But I've heard great things about this film. Also, Julian Schnabel's film, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, it played at Toronto, I think at Cannes as well, and has really gotten good reviews from what I've heard. So those are the three or four I'm most curious about. We've mentioned a couple of these, but movies we've seen and do recommend, again, if you get a chance to check out these films, Control, I've seen and recommend. Chicago 10, Sam and I saw at Sundance.
I'm really looking forward to that one. That's
that
about
one,
the Chicago 7 and those riots.
Yes, and the riots here in 1968. Grace Is Gone, as we said, and Michael Clayton, which you saw, your number 4 film from Toronto, I believe.
I liked it.
You did?
I liked it. It's a lot of fun.
That's also playing here. Director Tony Gilroy will be there for a gala presentation. And then Honey Dripper, the John Sayles film, which I did like. Sayles will be here. That film's playing in a gala presentation. So, again, some interviews we may have. Right now we're trying to line up. Laura Linney's a good possibility.
I know you're drooling over the fact that you might get a chance to interview John Sayles.
That's really the one I'm going to go after the most, because, as I said to you, if I had 10 guests I could have on Dream Guest, Sayles is a guy who would certainly make my top 10 of guests I want on the show. Also, James Strauss, the writer-director of Grace Is Gone, good chance we're going to have him on the show. So stay tuned to that coverage. Again, we'll have more coverage October 5th. Actually, our show will be October 12th, the Friday, October 12th show, the WBEZ Chicago Public Radio version. That will be our kind of Chicago Film Fest blowout.
And if you are in Chicago, pay attention to the film spotting boards, because we might have a local meetup.
That's exactly right.
And the information for that would be on there, www.filmspotting.net.
Let's move on, Maddie, to our Bergman Marathon, our first marathon together. Again, this was something that was your idea. You said with Bergman's passing, this would be a great opportunity to go back and see some of his films, movies maybe we've missed or just want to revisit. And Smiles of a Summer Night from 1955 is a film neither of us have seen, and we're both really excited about.
Yeah, well, I think this is terrific. Woody Allen, of course, considers Ingmar Bergman the greatest director to work, I believe the way he put it, since the invention of film.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bergman is famous for his dour, existential, frank scrutiny of the human condition. So I think it's absolutely fitting that we begin our marathon with Smiles of a Summer Night, which is a frank, existential sex comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Gunnar Bjornstedt stars as Frederick Egerman, successful turn-of-the-century lawyer, married to a much, much younger Anne, played by Ulla Jacobson, a marriage we learn that hasn't been consummated despite its lasting 2 years. Frederick still pines away for a former love, the actress Desiree Arnfeldt, played by Eva Dahlbeck. Throw in Henrik, Frederick's son, a theology student oversexed and tortured by a ribald maid, a jealous count, and his estranged wife, all invited to a remote estate for the weekend, and you have the makings of a wild romp in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
Adam, did you keep up with all that?
I did, actually.
Now, you and I are both familiar with some of Bergman's more stoic, solemn, famous works. In this genre, is Bergman's gaze into the soul of humanity as penetrating?
It's pretty close. I don't know if it is as penetrating. I think I maybe do appreciate those really serious, dour, solemn Bergman films more, but I really like this film. And you're right, there was something about starting out this marathon with this comedy of manners, this farce. It made me think of a movie we reviewed, Molière, and how that movie didn't work when it was trying to be a farce. And this really does work as a farce, and yet it's all very much Ingmar Bergman. It's life and death. It's a farce. It's a sex comedy. It's the blueprint for every kind of country weekend movie where a bunch of couples get away and a bunch of crazy things happen. But it's also the blueprint in many ways for every sex comedy. You've got the theology student, Henrik, who's tormented. He wants sex, but he also thinks it's against his virtue. And then you've got Petra, the maid, who's constantly teasing him. I mean, these are things we've all seen in high school sex comedy. So it's all there. And yet, like I said, it's all really life and death with Bergman. I mean, literally to the point where we get a scene where they play Russian roulette. Yeah. And there's one scene as well where Bergman has a moment where all of a sudden the wife of the count, the countess, starts delivering this tirade about how she hates her husband.
Oh, that's wonderful.
It is wonderful, but it's this classic kind of Bergman moment where it's the seeds of Autumn Sonata and the seeds of Persona, where it's even that famous Bergman shot. It's not as focused as the later shot that we see that has become kind of his trademark, but the shot where the countess is looking right into the camera and Anne Eggerman is looking at her in profile, and it's really penetrating, but it's serious. I mean, we've seen some crazy farcical comedic moments way over the top, and then all of a sudden we get this really impassioned, serious
speech. I actually have the line here. Men. She says, "Men are vain and conceited, and they have hair all over their bodies."
Right.
Ooh, it's brilliant the way she just spits it out.
It is.
And you're right. It's actually kind of two movies, because the first part where they're in the city is really sort of plays out like a Billy Wilder comedy of ill manners.
Sure.
I mean, this is risque for 1955 in the frank discussions that they have about sex.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's nothing redeeming, actually, about this lawyer. I mean, he at one point tells his son, a theology student, he says, "Sex is a young man and an old man's toy."
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually they go to this estate. So we get all that, we get the setup, and then it becomes, I think, we get introduced to the Bergman aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
We've gone now from the city into the country, which, of course, through the course of Western literature, when you're in the woods, that's where the magic, that's where the mischief happens. You know, you think of A Midsummer Night's Dream, famously.
And they even drink a potion.
Exactly, and they drink a potion. And then Bergman starts to put a stamp on it and becomes very, very surreal. And I think some people are going to fall away from the movie at that part.
Maybe.
Maybe, perhaps. But stay with it, because it is engrossing.
Yeah, it really is, and it pays off in some really magical Bergman moments. There is a scene that gets set up earlier where you don't really understand it, but a guy who works at the house, at the estate, shows Petra that if you push this certain thing on the wall, this magic moment happens where a bed comes through the wall. It's a secret kind of door or whatever. And later in the movie, then, of course, there's a moment where Henrik tries in despair
to hang himself,
and he ends up just pushing that, and it ends up being this moment of grace, this moment of redemption, where he pushes it, and as soon as he pushed it, and I knew what was going to happen, I said to Sarah, who was watching it with me, that you know Anne, of course, is going to be on the bed, because Henrik and Anne have been tormented. They've been in love. She's in love with her stepson, basically, with her husband's son from a previous marriage, and you know that she's going to be the one who comes through the wall in his moment of absolute despair, and she does, and he sees her there angelically on the bed, and that's the moment that he knows is like God has given her to him, and they share a kiss that really, when we finally do our top five screen kisses, that might be on my top five list. I really think it's that wonderful.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm going to disagree just a little bit, because I didn't think Henrik, as a theology student, was set up at the beginning that well. We didn't really, weren't that invested in his story. It's much more between the actress and Frederick and basically his advances towards her. So I didn't think, and one of my problems, and I think some people might have problems with this, are the resolutions to all the stories.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really, that's okay. It's more how we get there.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the resolutions, the Countess and the Count, isn't happy at all.
No, it's
not. It is completely unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yet, again, the way these people get there, that surreal dinner scene where the matriarch is, you know, presiding over
it. And she's got all the food and everything in front of her in the shot.
Yeah. And then he starts to break out his Bergman, you know, the famous, there's one face centered in the middle of the frame, you know, and they've got this longing look on them, and they espouse some kind of weird, you know, weird philosophical little nugget, you know, and you're like, yes, this is fun, you know.
It is. The whole movie's fun, and I liked the Count especially in these big comedic moments. This guy, the Count, who has this military background, and he has this great line earlier in the film where he says, you know, you can mess with my wife, but you touch my mistress, and I turn into a tiger. Yeah. I turn into a tiger. And then later, of course, we get the opposite. It's actually if you touch his wife, he turns into a tiger. It's a very funny moment, and there are a lot of funny moments throughout. So I think this was a great start to the marathon.
Yeah, wonderful.
And it will maybe be a little while before we get, unfortunately, to our next film in the Bergman Marathon. It's going to be 1957's The Seventh Seal,
right. But
it might be another month before we get to it because of some of the films that are coming out over this month. A lot of great fall movies coming out that we're going to focus on, but check the Film Spotting calendar at filmspotting.net for updates.
Okie doke, time for one last quick break. When we come back, Adam and I prove that we respect our cinematic elders. Stay with us.
I'm here at your party, trying not to hurt. In my melancholy trousers and my masochistic shirt. Hope I don't look awkward, doing all I could do to avoid the shade of blue on my best foot forward shoe.
Film Spotting's Top 5 is presented by Spout.com. Share your lists, reviews, and discuss movies with your friends for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
I think we have a chance to make this kind of a life-changing experience, and I think we need it.
I want us to become brothers again like we used to be.
You're the two most important people in the world to me.
This is incredible!
Why haven't we spoken in a year?
Because we don't trust each other.
Is that my belt?
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie, and it is Top 5 time here on the show. But first, a clip there from the new Wes Anderson film, the trailer for The Darjeeling Limited, which I have to admit, watching the trailer for the first time just a couple days ago, Maddie, actually did look pretty funny to me, so I am looking forward to that, as Sam and I said on our top five fall movies. But we shared poll results earlier in the show, but we did not get to the new poll question you can find on filmspotting.net. We want to ask you about Wes Anderson, and we want to know, what do you think his best film so far is?
Is it Bottle Rocket, Rushmore, Royal Tenenbaums, or The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou? Or, number five, none of the above. He's terribly, terribly overrated.
Maddie, how would you vote?
I would vote, I think, Bottle Rocket. Definitely. Okay. I think it's been diminishing returns since then.
Okay. For me, I think I would definitely be going against you and my previous co-host and say, I think maybe The Royal Tenenbaums.
No.
Yeah, I really like that film, and I think it's the best one
bunch. See, this is the problem. My problem with Wes Anderson is that he's injecting so much quirk into his movies. Now it's infecting every other independent art house film that's coming. I just saw King of California. I'm not going to go off on it. But there's so much quirk and irreverence hoisted onto that script. Knock it off.
Well, and how much has Wes Anderson come up just in the past 6 weeks on this show when talking about other films, including movies like Rocket Science?
Right.
It comes up all the time. So he has infected a lot of filmmakers, right. And you can decide whether or not that's a good or bad thing. And again, we want to know what you think about Wes Anderson. Which one is his best film so far? Or maybe you just think he's completely overrated. Go to filmspotting.net and make your voice heard. Okay, we are now at the top five, Maddie, and people may be wondering where this came from. Well, it's because of Hal Holbrook. The 82 or 83-year-old Hal Holbrook in Into the Wild, he gives a performance that a lot of people are talking about as maybe an Oscar-worthy performance, and it got us thinking about older actors and great performances from people in their later stages of life. There have been a number of really good ones, and I think we're calling this the Spencer Tracy Guess Who's Coming to Dinner Memorial List.
Well, we have a couple rules. They have to be over 65.
Correct.
They have to be able to receive Medicaid.
Uh-huh.
Right?
That's it.
So, with that in mind,
What's your number five, Maddie?
My number five is the great Lillian Gish in The Whales of August. She's, of course, one of the greatest actresses of the 20th century. You guys actually reviewed a movie she did, 1915, Birth of a Nation.
Yes.
And, of course, she's really famous for Night of the Hunter with Robert Mitchum, which I just watched a couple weeks ago, still holds up as a really terrifying movie. The Whales of August, she teams up with Vincent Price and Betty Davis. I mean, this is just a warm hug of a movie. It's based on a play, two elderly sisters, Summer in Maine, and of course the whales, every August, they pass closer to the shore, and now they aren't passing as close
anymore. It's a
metaphor. Oh, exactly. Uh-huh. And it is, it's just a wonderful reflection on the passing of the time.
Okay, a movie I do need to check out, and I actually do know that my number five is an actor in a performance from a movie you need to check out, and that is Richard Farnsworth in The Straight Story.
Right, oh yeah.
He died in 2000 at the age of 80, right after this film came out in 1999, actually suicide by gunshot. Until I looked this up, I'd completely forgotten that Farnsworth actually killed himself after being diagnosed with terminal cancer. But in The Straight Story, as Alvin Straight, who rides a John Deere tractor from Iowa up to Wisconsin to try to make amends before he dies, before his brother dies, with his brother who he's been estranged from for a while, played in the film by Harry Dean Stanton, and it happened in 1994. But this film, this performance from Richard Farnsworth, who I always think of as the assistant coach, the other manager in The Natural, but here he's just so plain spoken and unshowy. And there's a scene at the end of this film where he goes and is finally standing outside of Lyle's place. He's made it, and he yells his name a couple of times. He calls his name, and Lyle answers. And the relief and the emotion that Farnsworth displays there is really moving. It's really a tender, great moment, and in large part due to Farnsworth's great performance.
Great pick. I still need to see the movie.
Mm-hmm.
All right, my number four, the great Laurence Olivier. These are actually two films of his. Mm-hmm. 1976, John Schlesinger, The Marathon Man.
Yes.
Worth it just for that scene with him and Dustin Hoffman alone. You know, the dentist torture scene. Mm-hmm. Is it safe? And then a couple years later, he makes Boys from Brazil with Gregory Peck. Now, this is a flawed movie, but the reason I actually put it on there is I think it speaks more to our current situation because it deals with genetic engineering. And, of course, in 1977, we weren't really at that point. Now, mm-hmm. of course, we genetically engineer our livestock, our food, and, of course, there's questions. You know, while I'm thinking of it,
mm-hmm.
1979, Dracula, John Badham's Dracula, mm-hmm. he plays Von Helsing.
Yes, he does.
With Frank Langella and I think Donald Pleasence. That's a great movie.
Mm.
So there, a trifecta right there. Go check it out.
Okay, Laurence Olivier. I don't think too many people are going to question that choice there. Your number four. I also kind of cheated a little bit in having two performances as my number four, and I'm going with Ruth Gordon Minnie Castevet in Rosemary's Baby in Roman Polanski's film, of course, from 1968. She was 72 at the time. And then just a few years later, 1971, as Maude in Harold and Maude. And it's two really different performances in that Maude, of course, has this lust for life. And Minnie is the neighbor next door who seems really nice. And she always says and does the right thing. You know, she's always there for you, but seems a little too good to be true. Mm-hmm. There's something really conniving about her. And in this case, of course, we find out she wants to create the spawn of Satan, using Mia Farrow as a vehicle for the devil's child.
That's a great choice.
A great film. They're both great films and great performances.
All right. Well, my number three, Mr. Lee Strasberg from 1975. Now, actually, for my money, Michael Gazzo as Frank Pantangeli
is actually better
in this film. And they would both lose.
Two.
Yeah, they would both lose to De Niro, actually, mm-hmm. that year. And of course, Strasberg, he's the famed creator of the method acting technique. He was the mentor to the likes of Marilyn Monroe and Al Pacino. And famously, he only made about four films, and his detractors point out that basically every performance he makes after this one as Hyman Roth is basically a variation on Hyman Roth. But that's okay, because he is so good as this sort of grandfather villain. And it's worth it alone for that scene in Miami where they're dividing up Havana by slicing mm-hmm. the cake. It's just terrific. And I also want to note, I was on IMDb, and he was named the Golden Globe's Best Newcomer for 1975, despite the fact he was 73.
At 73. Fantastic. Actually, though, I do want to correct you. I think they're in Cuba by that point, aren't
they? Are they in Cuba?
Cutting up the cake, of course, dividing up his land as he cuts the cake.
Yeah, just a great scene.
There it is, dividing up his empire, if you will. And it's funny that you bring him up, because I wondered if you would, because he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, but you even mentioned to me once that he kind of plays the same character all the time. He plays that variation. But
right, and I won't bore our audience by going, I'm an actor and I have my issues with the method acting technique, so I don't need to take my soapbox here, but I'm man enough to say that's a terrific performance.
Okay, you can see past it. I respect that. My number three, speaking of Ingmar Bergman, I've got Victor Sjostrom from Wild Strawberries,
ooh,
a film we are going to get to in this marathon. Like my previous choices here, actually, it really deals with old age and mortality. He was 80 when he made the film in 1959. He's an old professor who goes to claim an award from a university and ends up confronting his past along the way and really having to question some of the decisions he's made about maybe this life he's chosen, a very cold existence. And I've said before on the show that you see this later in Woody Allen's Deconstructing Harry. You also see it in Another Woman. Jenna Rollins, in very many ways, is the Victor Sjostrom character, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right. But it's a great performance in large part because so much of it is nonverbal. These nightmare sequences that he has, yeah, these dream sequences he has, are nonverbal. He's confronting things, confronting visions, and just the looks on his face and his reactions are enough to convey all the emotions we need. It's a very understated performance, again, much like Richard Farnsworth. So he's my number three.
And we'll be reviewing that movie, mm-hmm,
Two or three slots down the road. That's right, in the Bergman Marathon.
Looking forward to it. All right, my number two, the great Jessica Tandy. For two movies, actually, for Driving Miss Daisy and Fried Green Tomatoes. And now it's funny because Jessica Tandy was a renowned stage actress. For the better part of her life, she worked with Hume Cronin, her real-life, mm-hmm, husband, and, of course, Sir Tyrone Guthrie. And they did everything from Beckett. She won a Tony for originating the role of Blanche DuBois in Streetcar, mm-hmm, in 1948. But we really didn't get to know her, especially my generation, until Driving Miss Daisy and Fried Green Tomatoes. And she's fantastic.
Yeah, she is. She is really good. And we did spare you the Driving Miss Daisy seat, yes, for Massacre Theater. Yes. But don't think we didn't consider how funny it might be for one of us to be Jessica Tandy and the other to be Morgan Freeman. I now wish we had kind of done it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the FCC is very happy we didn't.
It would have been mildly offensive, to say the least, but it would have been more fun, I think, than the scene we chose.
All right, anyway, what's your number two?
My number two is a performance. I'm actually going to be very surprised if it's not your number one or that it didn't make your list, and it's Jack Lemmon. Ooh. In Glengarry Glen Ross, which everyone knows, we love that film. All three of us here, my former co-host included, but Shelley the Machine Levine in Glengarry from 1992. He was 67 at the time, so he just made the cut. But he really brings humor and dignity to what is in many ways a really pathetic character. And at times you do want him to just go to lunch, like Williamson tells him to, and to quit begging for the good leads, because again, it's so pathetic. But you also understand how desperate he is, and you do feel for him. And I think it's one of the better performances in a film filled with outstanding performances all the way around.
I think on repeat viewing, actually, his performance stands out as the best.
Okay.
He and Ed Harris as Moss are both absolutely terrific. And of course, you've got to name this performance because it actually spawned, how iconic is it? It spawned a character on The Simpsons. Gil is based off of that performance in Glengarry Glen Ross.
I did not know that.
You did not know?
Not enough of
you
a Simpsons aficionado.
Gil's got to get the leads.
All right, here we are. We finally arrive at Maddie Ball Games in number one. What is it?
My number one, no big surprise, it's a tie. Same movie, 1981, Henry Fonda and Katharine Hepburn in On Golden Pond.
Are you serious?
I love that movie.
Really?
You don't like that movie?
I don't think I've ever taken the time to see it, to be honest. I've never been that curious about it. It looked cheesy to me.
Oh, my God.
Are you serious? Yes, totally.
It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. You have two of the greatest actors of all time, mm-hmm, working with one of the greatest scripts of all time, a stage play by Ernest Thompson. It's absolutely beautiful. I love it because you're looking at this family and it reflects your... We just got done watching Bergman.
Mm-hmm.
You watch this family, you recognize this family because they reflect your own humanity, your own humor, and certainly your own failings. And you just love spending time with those characters.
Okay. You have convinced me.
I cannot believe you have not seen
it. I haven't.
Oh my.
I've never been that curious about it. I really have not. I have to admit it. Okay. Well, we're at my number one, and a lot of people probably see this one coming. I can't wait for you to roll your eyes a little bit and laugh. Let's hear a clip.
I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Of course, the classic scene, one of the all-time most quotable scenes in cinema history, Peter Finch as Howard Beale in Network, Sidney Lumet's film Network with Paddy Chayefsky. It helps when you're reciting Paddy Chayefsky's brilliant script, his brilliant speech there, but who doesn't hear that and want to get up and go to the window and shout, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore? He's a broken man. He's going insane slowly, but He's incredibly charismatic. I can completely understand watching his performance in that film, how people would watch his show, how it would become a hit show. And I will also confess I'm cheating just a little bit. I like the performance so much I had to include it. He was actually 64.
No, Adam, that was expressly against the rules.
Care.
Do you realize how many people I had to not include?
Not include? Well, sorry. Get used to it.
It's ridiculous.
We break rules all the time here in the top five. He was 64. He died actually the year after this was made. He had to accept or not accept his Oscar posthumously, of course. I think he's the only one who has actually won Best Actor posthumously. So Peter Finch, he's my number one.
Yeah, it is a great performance. A movie I certainly have problems with, but it is a brilliant performance. So those are our top five senior citizens on screen. Send your list or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net. Remember, they have to have been eligible for Medicaid.
Or not.
This is terrible. This is get my lawyer on the phone. I have an escape clause here, right? You can also give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voice message.
I didn't realize I would outrage you so, but I like the passion,
Maddie.
There are
rules. This is not numb.
New in theaters this weekend, Feast of Love with Selma Blair, Morgan
Freeman.
Who
cares anymore?
It doesn't matter.
I follow the script.
It's all anarchy, isn't it? And Greg Kinnear in that film. Also, The Game Plan with The Rock and The Kingdom with Jamie Foxx, Jennifer Garner, and Jason Bateman. Also, In the Valley of Elah, which we reviewed on last week's show, is expanding to more screens. Next week, the plan right now, Maddie, will have reviews of The Darjeeling Limited, mm-hmm. the Wes Anderson film, of course, and The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. We may also sneak in some comments on another Western still in theaters, James Mangold's 310 to Yuma, which I have still not caught up with, but you have seen. So
I did. Yeah.
We're also going to try to fit that in next week.
All right. Well, thanks to Alex and Angela on our message boards, Frank Huckle and Candace Griffiths. Thanks also to Bottle Rockets and Bloodshot Records for this week's music. Learn more at bloodshotrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I am an outraged Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout. Visit filmspotting.spout.com to discuss this episode. Okay, onto the spoiler edition, the ending of In the Valley of Elah, my idea, how to make it better. Earlier in the film, Tommy Lee Jones is driving. He drives by a school or some building where the person putting up the flag has had trouble and it's upside down, and he stops in a really bad haggis moment of writing and tells us how if the flag is upside down, it means the country is in distress,
right.
I think is the
right.
line, and we're all lost. Being a good military man that he is, a good patriot, he turns the flag right side up. You know it's going to come back into play later, and it does at the end of the film, after he's totally had all his visions of the world, I guess, in some ways, dashed by learning the truth about his son. He drives back into town, and we see him actually get out, put the flag upside down, and duct tape it that way so it stays that way. And it's a really bad, heavy-handed moment. It's also bad because we don't buy at all, I don't think, that Tommy Lee Jones, who has up to this point not been political at all, would act in that kind of overt a way. So it doesn't work. That's what we hated. And other listeners who have written in have agreed with us. They hated it too. At least one of our listeners really liked that moment, though. And I just want to throw out there how it could have been better. Why couldn't he have simply had, in terms of subtlety and being less heavy-handed, just had Tommy Lee Jones driving back into town, see that the flag is still upside down or it's been turned upside down again, and just look at it and maybe consider for a moment that, you know what, his initial instinct is to turn it right side up and then decide, you know what, maybe it's right.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's right that way. Maybe the country really is in distress and we're lost and I'm just going to keep on driving and worry about other things. That would have been a perfect, subtle moment that expressed the same point, and instead we get haggis just bludgeoning us with it.
Yeah, that's inspired stuff.
Thank you.